The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. This is Bill, and to quote the great Matthew McConaughey, "All right, all right, all right, welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast." This is episode 4, Fixing Fight Club. Intelligence failure is a feature and not a bug. So some housekeeping before we get into the meat of our conversation today. For those of you who have come to War Notes and you've hopefully spread the word to friends and colleagues and acquaintances who may be interested in the material that I'm covering here, I have paused my fortnightly production of Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast to create this new companion podcast to Chasing Ghosts, in which I will expand my historical and contemporaneous investigative portfolio to cover things in conventional warfare and strategic and grand strategic conflict, and maybe even a renewal, renaissance, and reconstitution of what I feel is a needed imprimatur to get the West's house straight when it comes to the conduct of conflict and the wielding of martial arms. So I'd be obliged if you spread the word, if you came to my Substack, and whenever I publish a new episode there, you can find it on my Substack page, in which I have a comments function, which is one of the primary reasons I started my Substack page in the first place, was so that I could have this conversation and hear from my listeners, readers, and interlocutors. So I would really be obliged if you took the time to visit the Substack. And if you wish to get in touch with me, you can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. All of this will be in the show notes. You will find this podcast on your favorite podcast vendor. So with that, let's get started. Now, I try to keep these not like Dan Carlin, as much as I love hardcore history and what he does, I can't do the hours long that he does in his podcasts. For instance, Martyr May does the same thing. Love Daryl's podcast. CJ Kilmer does the same thing with CJ's Dangerous History podcast. I haven't gotten to the point where I'm comfortable with doing an hours long podcast on a subject. Maybe that'll come in the future. Maybe it'll come sooner than later once I can retire from my day job and maybe pay much more attention to doing both War Notes, what you're listening to today, and also Chasing Ghosts, which is my first love, of course, as all of you know. And by the way, Chasing Ghosts has 56 episodes under its belt, so congratulations to me. So I've talked about intelligence before, and in this case, we're talking about both civilian and military intelligence. We will use intelligence as the rubric not of corporate or private intelligence, but in our discussion today, we will confine ourselves to what is done by government intelligence agencies, East and West, in this case, mostly West. As a matter of fact, in this case, mostly America, and its satraps in the Pacific and also in the EU and NATO. And we'll discuss just a few things about the fundamentals, because I think that there are plenty of podcasts or books, and I will put several books in the show notes, if you wish a deeper dive into the nuts and bolts and the bones and the superstructure, substructure, and overall structure of intelligence, how it relates to analysis, how it relates to tactical, operational, strategic, and grand strategic venues and war fighting. And also just to give you a much deeper dive in what I can't cover in a lot of depth today. So let's cover the basics first. For those of you who just landed here from Mars, you've never been exposed whatsoever to any media sources, news sources, book sources, or anything about intelligence, maybe you're even new to the English language, and you ask yourself, what the heck is intelligence, and what am I speaking to? Here's what we're talking about, is that we are pattern recognition, critically thinking minds, for the most part, that apprehend the universe and the world around us through the gathering of information, the critical distinction of pattern relationships, whether it's contrast, whether it's comparative, or whatever the case may be. As a matter of fact, critical thinking and intelligence are married at the hip. You can't have one without the other. Can you abuse one without the other? Can the preamble of critical thinking be so misused, warped, and corrupted that whatever intelligence comes from centuries-long identification of fallacious argumentation, deep Socratic reasoning, and deep dives and drilling of premises and, well, what is the conclusion that we've drawn? What supports that conclusion? What are the hand receipts? What are the footnotes? What are the syntopical, I've talked about that before, in Mortimer Adler's brilliant book, How to Read a Book. I'll put that in the show notes too. I recommend everybody have that in your library. It's simply where you read at a minimum or consume at a minimum, maybe you're using Audible or whatever the case may be, 3 to 5 books in this case on the same subject. And by reading those 3 to 5, if you are an active reader, in Adler's words, a level 3 or level 4 reader, and you're really interrogating what you're reading, you're reading between the lines. Maybe you even take the time, like I've done, to read footnotes. I find footnotes really fascinating, and it tends to buttress the arguments of folks that I'm interrogating when I'm reading and I'm trying to get what I consider. And if you come away with one phrase from this entire time I'm going to chat with you today, it would be single most accurate picture. Because in the end, that is the end state you seek with all intelligence. But we're going to step back just a moment, and I want you to imagine this. You have landed from Mars, or you're brand new to this. The information space is the total amount of inputs that you have into your brain case when you're thinking about the way the world works. And I'm hoping that you're critically thinking. And remember that critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. Brand that into your brain. And what you discover is that there is an ocean of information and data. I mean, we have disciplines today. I'll bet we employ hundreds of thousands of people in the West whose only job is data science, data management, data manipulation, and all the rest of it. Now, I want to put a slight proviso here, and that's this. There's all this talk of misinformation, malinformation, disinformation, what the Russians in their Soviet skin suit used to refer to as maskarovka and desinformatsiya, which is masking and deception and disinformation. I am here to tell you I have the most simple way to ensure that mal, mis, and disinformation can be dispensed with in the best way possible, ensuring that human liberty prospers, and that is free speech. You can't have hate speech without free speech. You can't have critical thinking without free speech. And you can't dissolve mal, mis, and disinformation without free speech. So that is the be-all and end-all for me. So back to our regularly scheduled program on information. What you discover with information is that we are absolutely inundated with it. I happen to be what is referred to as neurodiverse. I am not a neurotypical human being. I am on the autism spectrum. Man, that must be a surprise to some people. But nonetheless, I'm highly functioning, maybe less highly functioning if you were to talk to my wife. But nonetheless, I find myself gifted with what being on the spectrum, being autistic, or what they used to call having Asperger's does to my ability to apprehend the world. So we've got this very large, vast swath of information. And then within that information, in a much smaller sphere, we have what's called intelligence. And intelligence would be those divinations from this ocean of information that sort of focuses with a laser-like intensity what it is we want to concentrate on from there to deliver a single most accurate picture. For instance, if I was in military intelligence, I would be looking at the composition and disposition of forces. Composition would be, what do they have? Disposition is, where are they, and how fast do they move? Concentrations and all the rest of it. And what you discover, too, in military intelligence, and I think that to a broader extent, this paints all kinds of intelligence to include private sector intelligence that is used for the conduct of business, is that, and I'm not saying we can boil this down because we're speaking to a very complex subject here. There was a brilliant book called The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis. Again, you can get it free on PDF. You can buy it on Amazon if you want. I would urge you to get it free on PDF. I will also put that in the show notes. And it was a CIA analyst who talked about what is this psychology that informs intelligence analysis. And by the way, for the sake of simplicity, we are going to sort of confine ourselves to a military intelligence analytical viewpoint when we're trying to put this together, and I can give you a demonstration project on how the process works. So I just discussed disposition and composition, which can be found by any number of ways. It could be human intelligence. It could be espionage. It could be imagery intelligence, which is non-air breathing or air breathing, which means satellite or reconnaissance aircraft, in this case, both unmanned and manned, unlike what used to happen in the 20th century and before. And all of these variants of acquisition of what do things look like, where are they in time of space, and where can they move to. Now, this brings us to what I would consider to be one of the very most important aspects of intelligence, and that would be this: capabilities and intentions. And then I want to ramble just a tad before we get into that, and that's this. There's something called situational understanding and situational awareness. And I want to give you a quick illustration. We've all heard, you've seen Hollywood movies where they say, what's the BDI on that target set that's just been prosecuted? For instance, that would be the battle damage intelligence, or they'll say the BDA, the battle damage assessment. Now, mind you, remember that the preamble to the assessment is the intelligence. You cannot arrive at a single most accurate picture of what something is if you don't have all the data in front of you and all those puzzle pieces and Lego pieces that tell you what's happening. So situational awareness, that's pretty darn easy. It means that you are cataloging what is in front of you, that through human consensus with those in the room or maybe around the world and you're in comms with them, you can all agree that, yep, that's a tank. Oh, those are aircraft. That's a refueling depot. Those are soldiers in whatever strength it may be, from platoon to regimental to division to army, whatever the case may be. That is situational awareness. Situational understanding is where you have an actual ability to grok not only what you see in front of you, but what its potential for action is. In physics, we talk about work. The universe is work. All work is the expenditure of energy, the movement of things, and the reconstitution of things. So the reason I bring that up is because capabilities and intentions. These, it's sort of like the dividing line between the amateur and the professional and seasoned military intelligence analyst, and it could be like young Commander Layton before the Battle of Midway, after the Battle of Pearl Harbor, who is advising Admiral Nimitz, who has just arrived in Hawaii, on what's going on, and insist, with the help of his cryptologic section, that there will be an attack by Kitobutai. In this case, that would be the 4 to 6 carriers, depending on, again, their disposition. Where are they? Where are they? Their composition. How many carriers are there at the time in Kitobutai, which was, by the way, the largest amalgamation of naval aviation and strength and targeting and fighting strength on the planet. No one came close. The U.S. would come close many months later. But nonetheless, what Layton was able to do was to predict where, just about, attacks would occur, where they would occur, and what strength. With that, through the use of surprise and deception, even though the Japanese thought that they were doing that, I would urge you, if you're interested in the Battle of Midway, There's a book called Shattered Sword. I will put that in the footnotes. And what's great about Shattered Sword for the you military historians out there is that not only did the author go to the English archives, but English-speaking archives, but he went to the Japanese archives, and he was able to get, again, a single most accurate picture of exactly what happened then. Because military intelligence and the use of it, and in a broader extent, intelligence at all, planet-wide, is fraught with problems, mistakes, errors, apprehension difficulties, and, of course, the most esoteric and arcane thing of all is you can know the capabilities, but what's the intention of using those things, and how will they be used against you if you decide to go to them head-to-head, in this case, in warfare? You know that I am fond of saying, it's almost a tagline for Chasing Ghosts, that all conflicts are won by the least incompetent forces. I stand by that. I think that universally that tends to be the case. In this case, what I'm after is, how do I get that single most accurate picture? I get that single most accurate picture by querying what the enemy's capability is, and from there I extend, what is the intention for what they're going to do? If you are conversant in the military decision-making process, and again, I'll put that in the show notes too, the commander, whatever level he's at, battalion, regimental, division, corps, army, no matter how many stars or not stars happen to be on his lapel when you're in the room with him and you are assigned as the S2 or military intelligence officer, he wants to know, what's my worst case scenario? What's my best case scenario? What is the enemy going to do? And how can I make sure that I can take advantage, if not neutralize and destroy the enemy, if that happens to be the intent from my higher echelons when I get into this conflict? And what that means is that intelligence analysts, besides being some of the brightest people in the room, also have to have the moral courage to red team, to be contrarians, to be 10th men, to be the folks who stand up and say, this is the worst case scenario, this is the best case scenario, this is the war-winning strategy, or in this case, a battle-winning strategy, possibly. What they're trying to do is offer the commander, or maybe it could be a civilian oversight modality. You might be working in one of the civilian intelligence agencies, and you want to provide them with the means in which they have the decision-making tools to come out on top. That's what it all comes down to. But if you don't have the moral courage to red cell this and to give bad news to a commander and to not become a colon connoisseur and simply try to judge, well, what does he want to hear? Because if you do that, lives will be lost, blood will be spilled, and shields and spears will be shattered. And there is an inherent imperfectibility of this because we're dealing with humans. We're dealing with people who may not be acquainted with their own bias filters, much less the bias filters that they encounter on an everyday basis with friends, family, colleagues, acquaintances, whatever may happen, maybe even the Congress with strangers in the public spaces. What you discover is that if you can identify your bias filter and you know the bias filter of what you're reading, listening to, watching, or whatever the case may be, again, you may be able to arrive at that single most accurate picture, holy grail, that I am always after in my intellectual life. And what I discover, for instance, is that I always tell people, don't watch the news. Not only will it make you depressed, not only will you be ill-informed, because to me, for the most part, when it comes to the corporate media, which I refer to the coprophile or coprophagy media, which is dying, thank the gods, don't watch that. That stuff is cooked. It's cooked to manipulate you. There's a reason they call it programming. So if you want to know what the news is, then what I urge you to do is read editorials, read opinion pieces. For instance, I will on occasion go to the Washington Post or the New York Times and see what they're saying, because I use, and the Atlantic, which is the bespoke and very elegant, probably house propaganda organ for the DNC CPUSA in America today. The Atlantic used to be good decades ago, but now it's nothing more than a government supremacist rag. But what I discover is that if I read opinion pieces, and again, I don't agree with what The Atlantic or The New York Times or The Washington Post says for the most part, but I read them so I can get the insight. Since 1998, I have been going to antiwar.com. And I find that on antiwar.com, it's an aggregator of a lot of news items from around the world, but it's also an aggregator of opinion pieces, and I found it extraordinarily useful. Little did I know in 1998 that fast forward to today, and I find myself honored by being the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute, run by Scott Horton, who also happens to be a bigwig at antiwar.com. The world is a very small place. There's a competence bridge that I want to discuss very briefly, and that's this. You have four steps. You have unconscious incompetence, conscious incompetence, conscious competence, and unconscious competence. And we're always trying to get right of that midline so that we can become both conscious and unconsciously competent. What you find when I discussed pattern relationships and language and the way it shapes how we view and apprehend the world around us is that language is really important, and language can be important in an unconscious fashion. And I want you, if you're going to be really serious about trying to take maybe an intelligence-centric view of the world, then what you want to do is you want to be careful with your language. I offer you this brief example. Before 1860, it was given in the United States that most people would say and read, "These United States are," which was an unconscious implication that the federal government was subservient to the states. After 1865 and the Lincolnian Revolution, in which the entire United States was put on the plantation, is that we have the United States is becoming the common argo throughout all communication in the United States and received literature and news. So just that subtle differentiation in a span of probably less than 10 years, all of a sudden completely flipped the script so that the states were not the leader of a weak federal government, but that they were simply, they became satraps of the federal government, just provincial offices of the federal government. They would do what the federal government told them to because the war that America had just experienced insisted on it. So again, stay with me on the path. Now, you have this information ocean, massive. You have intelligence, a much smaller circle, mind you, of information that we're focusing on. And then you have this really tricky venue called actionable intelligence. And what actionable intelligence is, you've divined the information into intelligence. You've zeroed in and focused on what it is you want to find on composition, disposition, capability, intention, and all of those other things that come into this so that we can work our way from situational awareness to situational understanding. Because absent situational understanding, we won't be able to take action that will service the intent of whatever we're trying to achieve. By the way, I was at the conference this week and somebody mentioned, "Bill, it's almost like you put 4 hours into a 1 hour lecture." Well, yes, I do. I only have so much time in this mortal coil, so I'm trying to make the best of it. I spoke on anti-fragility and future conflict at an emerging techniques forum that was hosted on the East Coast. I really enjoyed doing that. Great to meet the people who were there, really cutting edge and bleeding edge thinking on what 21st century conflict looks like. Maybe I'll cover that in a future episode, but back to what we were talking about here, we're concentrating on actionable intelligence, which becomes what is that intelligence that we have defined in which we can service it directly or put the parts and pieces and components in place so that over time and maybe on an intermediate or long-term time horizon, we will achieve these things if we start marching in this direction, for instance. I remember Lewis Carroll, and I'm paraphrasing here from Alice in Wonderland, you know, if you don't have an azimuth or a direction you're going, you'll get there eventually. So I've given you a primer on what intelligence is about. And by the way, there are people, myself included, having been in the intelligence community myself, both as a military fellow and civilian, you could spend decades in the trade to perfect the craft. By the way, I don't think you can perfect the craft. I think you could become, you can achieve a level of mastery because of unconscious competence, vast and deep reading, experiential databases, the intuition engines that form through that unconscious competence that I mentioned, where someone can give you an assessment of what's happening in a certain country, for instance. And then you may scratch your head because it's a very young analyst who's giving you this analysis, and they're dead to rights on the composition. They're dead to rights on where they're going. They're dead to rights on the capabilities, but they are so wrong-headed when it comes to intention, because intention is the sine qua non of seeing who the seasoned intelligence operative or analyst is, who really knows their trade and can tell you with a fair amount of consistency in a fairly, if unremarkable, forecast, not prediction, but forecast, what's going to happen and what the percentages are that are allayed to that. So there you are. I've given you a beggared and incomplete primer on what intelligence is about, both in military and civilian intelligence. Now, presently in the United States, the U.S. intelligence community is composed of 18 organizations, two independent agencies, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the Central Intelligence Agency, 9 DOD, Department of Defense elements, that would be the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, don't say that last acronym in polite company, the National Reconnaissance Office, and intelligence elements of the 5 DOD services, which would be the Army, the Navy, Uncle Sam's Misguided Children, the Air Force, and Space Force. There's 7 elements of other departments of agencies. There's the Department of Energy's Office of Intelligence and Counterintelligence, Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, U.S. Coast Guard Intelligence, DOJ, FBI, and DEA, Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and the Department of the Treasury's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, all for the bargain basement price of $100 billion, which is about $76 billion for the National Intelligence Program, and then DOD is $30 billion. But I guarantee you that DOD $30 billion out of an $850 billion budget is far greater than that in what is spent, but sort of fudged. So there's the agencies, and I want to take you on a very quick trip down memory lane to 1947, when the Central Intelligence Agency is birthed from the ashes of the Office of Strategic Services that was used during World War II to run espionage activities, and in concert with Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, set both Europe and the Pacific theater ablaze with guerrilla operations, espionage activities, subversion activities, masking and deception activities, misinformation, disinformation, propaganda activities, and all the rest. So we have the CIA in 1947 under some very odious and capable Machiavellian intriguers like the Dulles brothers. And a marriage between the intelligence agencies and the Department of State was quickly instantiated in 47, 48, and 49 and solidified itself for decades afterwards. And there was a fork in the road. Mind you, it was maybe where they bifurcated the intelligence agency and the powers that be asked them to do two things. I want you to provide the world's best and most well-reasoned analytical products for decision makers so that when decision makers, especially when it comes to foreign policy, are taking their decisions, they're as well-informed as possible. And then there's the covert services, the offices of clandestine services, the black operations. The distinction, by the way, between covert and clandestine is black to black, and covert would be where one would be an intelligence asset at an embassy overseas, but you're the agricultural attaché or the parks and recreation attaché, whatever the case may be. But nonetheless, they started the tomfoolery of employing espionage assets, trying to find agents and disloyal people within countries that were targeted to turn on their countries, to manipulate the political destinies of these countries to make them neutral or beneficial to the national security concerns of the U.S. and the West. They would employ color revolutions, which are basically using the political and voting mechanisms which within a given state and using both black and vanilla means to influence and steer the directions so that whatever political power was granted to a given party would be beneficial to the U.S. and the West. Of course, a lot of this went awry. Like in 1953, the Iranian authorities are deposed and in place a puppet for the United States and the West is installed. In the 1950s, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of Eastern European emigres who were trained by the intelligence agencies to become stay-behinds or disruptors or guerrillas in Eastern European Warsaw Pact countries at that time and Russia. And the espionage leakage and the security leakage was so bad in the U.S. and Western intelligence community that quite literally the NKVD or the KGB would be waiting at the landing zone for the parachute drops to grab them and maybe either kill them, jail them, or turn them into double agents and potentially triple agents. I recommend two books that will give you all the information, well, most of the information that you need to arrive at a decision on yourself on the efficacy of these operations, starting in 1947 and well into the 21st century. The Ghosts of Langley into the CIA's Heart of Darkness by John Prados, and then Legacy of Ashes by Michael Weiner. I recommend both of these books to give you a very unvarnished glimpse into just how awful this kind of clandestine, covert, color revolution, and meddling interference campaigns planet-wide has just made the world much worse off than it ever would have been if none of this occurred. So I would say that I would not condemn the analytical products and the analytical structures within the intelligence agencies to provide what I assume they would want to do, which is provide the very best intelligence products that would tell them, here's composition, disposition, and here's what the capabilities are of these forces or political entities, and these are their intentions. Because intentions, the divination of what is the neutral or adversarial foe going to do that impacts, in the end, from military intelligence and CIA perspective, the national security status of the U.S. and the West, those are the important things to answer. But what we've discovered, and again, this sort of speaks to anti-fragility and fragility, is that they have these very fragile infrastructures that are very politically influenced, shaped, and motivated that tend not to have that moral courage I spoke of earlier, and tend to provide, for instance, in the presidential intelligence briefing that is viewed every day, apparently, since time immemorial by the candidate in the Oval Office who has won or his subsidiaries who may take advantage of a deep dive into those analytical products every morning, that talks about the decision-making process for the next 24 hours, 24 days, or even 24 years as far as what America's foreign policy in this instance is going to look like. As I have bored you with in the past, since 1945, the U.S., and I would say for the most part the West, but I will say the U.S. has a practically unvarnished record of military defeat and stalemate since that time, and has been at war probably for all but a handful of days since 1791. And of course, we've seen after World War II and the conclusion of that war and the communist dominion over half the world as a result of bad decisions that were made during the entirety of that sordid conflict, which actually started in 1914, because World War I and World War II are a war of the world that had a slight interregnum for things to reconfigure themselves in the 20s and 30s for the big finale that would come from 39 to 45. So what I'm speaking to here when it comes to anti-fragility and fragility is that, as you know, for those of you who have listened before, it is my suggestion that all insurgencies tend to be anti-fragile and that all counterinsurgencies tend to be fragile for a variety of reasons, and you can listen to episodes 2 and 4 for an in-depth treatment of that suggestion in the Chasing Ghosts podcast if you want to dig into that any further. There are so many foreign chaos avalanches that are created by this kind of sophisticated meddling in other countries' affairs. For instance, what you discover is that Saddam Hussein in the 1980s is a federal employee. Manuel Noriega is a federal employee. Osama bin Laden is a federal employee. And you find that with these countries, all of a sudden, the opposite track starts to be operationalized, and we find that through subsidy from both the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and others, that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda start conducting terrorist attacks, whether it was in 1993 in New York, or the coal bombing, or the U.S. embassies in Africa that were targeted by al-Qaeda, finally culminating on 9/11. Fast forward to the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively, the expansion between 2008 and 2016 into Libya, Yemen, and Syria. As a matter of fact, Obama deployed the Brennan CIA in a regime change operation to begin the Syrian civil war to take out Assad so that armed jihadists could be installed. And this, in turn, created ISIS, and this, in turn, had a cavalcade of calamities that ripped across the entire Middle East. As a matter of fact, at one point before October 7th, 2023, when Gaza conducted their guerrilla campaign into Israel proper and Israel was caught with their pants down, what you found was that from the western reaches of Mali all the way to the Indian and Pakistan border, the world was on fire excepting Egypt. And then after October 7th, 2023 of last year, Egypt is afire and subject to unrest and subject to color revolutions and regime changes that were influenced greatly by the West. For instance, what you see in the Ukraine is in 2004 and 2005 and 2014, color revolutions culminating in the Maidan Revolution in 2014 installed a Western sympathetic government that was seeking entrance into NATO. And William Burns, then ambassador to Russia in 2008, now the CIA director, and you can't put the two together without thinking, why aren't they thinking? He says in a cable from the State Department that Putin and his government in 2008 has made it very clear that the Ukraine is a red line. It is a mark in the sand. It is a place that they will not accept any challenge for entrance or auxiliary membership into NATO. And it is a war strategy to do that. And now we have the special military operation that's going on over, 2 years old that has wrested certain eastern territories from the Ukraine, which I forecast they will never get back. Now, Ukrainian entrance into NATO is still an open question, but a very bad question. And again, what you find in critical thinking is it isn't the quality of the answers that counts. It's the quality of the questions that guide you to the answers that you need to make the assessment. In this case, capabilities are easy to see, but what are intentions? Because intentions are the sine qua non, the raison d'etre of why you have intelligence agencies conducting the analytics that they do. And by the way, the intelligence agencies in the West, and in particular, we will treat the CIA and such, and the U.S. intelligence agencies get so much wrong so much of the time, all the time, that one wonders at any president who would have any faith or any operational political authority that has Congress and maybe consensus or interactions with foreign countries, why they would believe a thing that comes out of their agencies. Because you'll find that before 1989 and 91, it was the Kremlinologist consensus in all the intelligence agencies in the West, with certain exceptions, that not only would the Soviet Union prevail because communism was so much better than the free market, but that they would be there forever. The Warsaw Pact would never collapse. And of course, we see from 1989 to 1991, what happens? We see the complete collapse. The calving off of, I think, 10 of the Stan brothers on the former Soviet underbelly into other countries that start to dissolve in their own regional conflict complexes and breathe oxygen into the embers of century-old conflicts, as we saw just after World War II in the Eastern European countries and what happened in Poland and some of the other countries, for instance. This is not unique to America. I mean, you can look at the colonial empires of the past that pretty much all reached their expiry date after World War II, but you look at the British, the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, any number of these, whether they're in Africa or Indochina or other parts of the world, they would always use their political and shaping influences and their intelligence organizations to topple or point in a direction the behavior and intentions of those client countries so that they would be more conducive to what the mother country, in this case, for instance, the British Empire, desired. And in an unpaid plug to Scott Horton, whose book Provoked just got released, which is a very well-documented and footnoted tome on why the Russian conflict in the Ukraine occurred and how the West was culpable in making all of this happen, in addition to the other canon that he has done, like Fool's Errand about the war in Afghanistan and such, what you discover is that there is so much chicanery and misbehavior and mischief and mayhem that the intelligence agencies have committed on the planet to make a far less stable and less peaceful place than it would have been without that meddling, in my estimation. So that is the preamble. That's sort of like setting the stage for what can we do to fix and reconstitute and maybe get rid of entire swaths of this intelligence community that has so ensnared the U.S. and the West and made liberty and freedom to be in the hazard for the most part as a result of what's been done overseas. Because there must be a law to this effect, but I've often said in the past that whatever an empire, and don't spare your feelings, the United States has been an empire since 1893. Whatever empires do abroad, they always bring it home. The UK and the British are a primary example of that. Despite the fact that the UK is a third world country with one teetering first world city, in this case, London, nonetheless, they're still doing a tremendous amount of damage to their citizens, both at home and abroad, through the Machiavellian whispers and machinations of MI6 and MI5, their respective organizations that mimic the behavior of the FBI and the CIA. And mind you, I'm not proposing a fix. I'm proposing some solution sets that may make things more palatable for our relationships with the world and may stymie, if not completely neutralize, these efforts and meddling campaigns overseas that always seem to return to America as a grenade with the pin removed and put in our pants. It simply doesn't end well. Forever war isn't good for anybody but the state. Here are my modest propositions to right the state. Number one, retain analytic culture and make sure that you instantiate and institutionalize a characteristic of contrarianism, of red cells, of people who are engaging in gentlemanly disagreement, Socratic drilling, the constant revision, revisiting, and implementation of new information into the analytic frameworks that are at their disposal to arrive at that single most accurate picture. I don't think we need 18 intelligence agencies. I don't think that there are certain agencies that need to continue to exist. But nonetheless, a lot of consolidation can happen. A lot of money saving can be had. And first and foremost, espionage activities. Get rid of them. Stop them. Office of Clandestine Services, get rid of them. Stop them. It took the 1975 Church Committee to convince the intelligence community, which was a mere 30 years or less old at the time, to stop assassination campaigns against foreign leaders or foreign politicos. It simply doesn't work well, and it has blowback functionalities that cause a lot of conflicts that were dormant or non-existent to all of a sudden flame up into these raving conflicts, wars, and civil wars around the world. Stop meddling. Disband those services. Here's another thing we need to do. We need to get rid of the classification regime in the United States that protects hundreds of millions of documents that don't have to be classified back for decades, if not probably over a century. Here's what I propose. Completely revive this post-World War II 1947 to 1952 era classification regime of for official use only, confidential, secret, and top secret, and all the compartmented and segmented programs that are lateral to TS and above TS. Get rid of all of these things. As a matter of fact, here's a red line proposal. Before the year 2000, and maybe the Congress, oh my gosh, I hate the idea of having a blue ribbon commission that would examine this. But what they do is they take a determination that says, we're going to declassify everything before the year 2000. Whatever is accepted, in this case meaning that it's going to be kept secret, it has to be absolutely minimal. 95 to 97% of whatever is classified right now has two qualities. Number one, they always say, well, the sources have to be redacted to protect the sources so that they don't become endangered. Well, maybe you can do that by simply blacking them out. The sources, not the material. The sources. The other thing is, you find that a lot of the classification ex post facto, when you examine it, again, for those of you who know Latin, ex post facto ergo propter hoc, which simply means that whatever we contemporaneously assign to past things, we're making presentism arguments today to justify what we've done yesteryear. That needs to stop immediately. Now, if you're able to get rid of 95% of all the classified documents, remove the classification and put them out into the public sphere, you will also be saving a tremendous amount of money as far as archival storage, as far as those administrators who protect it, as far as the administrative armies that are out there and security professionals and such, whose entire raison d'etre for work in the government or maybe even the corporate sphere is to protect classification regimes and prosecute process crimes or the unintended release of said information. Another thing that this does too is that in these fart bubbles of intelligence throughout all of these agencies, the classification regime provides a manifest excuse for very lazy thinking in two respects. Number one, you have to limit the number of sources that are going to be entertained because you can't classify everything. But number two, you create a rationalization cycle with that limited amount of data where you haven't collated other data that is out there or your collection plans are immature. And what you discover is that you don't have all the parts and pieces. You don't have all the data components that allow you to arrive at that analytical structure that delivers that single most accurate picture. So for many reasons, and if anything, this would be a good conversation to have nationally, and I would love to see it start in the Congress or maybe even in the Senate, where they ask this very question: what is the efficacy of continuing the classification regime we have, which is ancient and nearly 80 years old? Why can't it be revised to the 21st century? Why can't sources be redacted, but the information itself be released? And I'll tell you one reason that acts as a tremendous disincentive for them not declassifying a lot of this and why it is classified for so long is because it hides mischief. It hides mistakes. It hides bad decision-making. It hides political misbehavior. And it hides all of those things that make the government as bad as it is. I think one can make military and civilian intelligence great again. One thing you find with the Reichswehr and the Wehrmacht, well, actually from 1805 to 1945, with the Prussian Renaissance and the German way of war, was that at every staff position, but for the most part at Army and the OKH in the case of World War II, which was where the general staff was, that was closest to the political leadership, they had military historians on staff. I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to have military historians, or maybe civilian historians, if we're talking about the State Department, whatever the case may be, those who have not only looked at what's occurred in history, but have done the syntopic inquiries to determine, well, what's worked and what hasn't worked. One of the great things about spending almost a quarter century in uniform was I was in one of those rare professions where you had mountains of books that one could read, memoirs or autobiographies, even though I think all autobiographies are fiction, battle analyses, war analyses, all of these things. This bloodless practicum of military history, bloodless for me, in which one could examine at length, in full, in depth, what worked in the past, what didn't work in the past. I am the proud owner of an almost complete collection of the Journal of Military History out of VMI, and they come out with a quarterly on that. And I have spent many a very interesting evening all of a sudden coming across something that is starting to answer questions to spaces or lacks of clarity in some historical circumstances that I hadn't examined before. And I can get that by examining this. What we need is we need that critical thinking. We need that spirit of inquiry. We need that moral courage to ask those questions in and out of the intelligence community. What is it that's going to make things better from an analytical perspective, from an information perspective, from an actionable intelligence perspective, that's going to make it so that America's interface with the world is more peaceful and less warlike? Because what you discover is that because of the intelligence regime in the U.S. and the West, and because of its behavior domestically, one can say that it is possible they participated in domestic color revolutions in the past 50 years. One doesn't know. There's much speculation out there, for instance, about JFK and his assassination. I don't spend a lot of time on that. I haven't invested hardly any inquiry into the circumstances of that. But imagine what a release of the documents, all of them concerning that, would do. But as I mentioned, classification serves two purposes. It serves the purpose of hiding government mischief, but it also serves the purpose of ensuring that people have power that other people don't, because they can withhold information that would make their decision-making process more leveled out. But because they're the only ones who have the information, it gives them an edge in the DC machinations of palace whispers and Machiavellian intrigue. In this political season, in the fall of 2024, we have seen, for instance, that recently 100 intelligence officials signed a document that said that Tulsi Gabbard is not competent enough to be DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. So if she's not, show your footnotes, show your hand receipts. As a matter of fact, I've seen some senators saying that, well, she's a Russian asset. Well, actually, she's a serving U.S. Army Reserve lieutenant colonel. If she is a Russian asset, then prefer charges, court-martial her. Let's bring all of this into the light, because they've been hiding in the dark for so long that humans are built on incentives. And if they know there's not a butcher's bill to be paid by them, but to be paid by others, and that anything that they happen to do wrong will remain in darkness, and they won't be held accountable for what happens, that makes for horrible outcomes historically. So in the end, my recommendation is they need to reduce the intelligence agencies to fewer than the 18 that we have. They need to absolutely burn the intelligence classification regime to the ground and start something anew that makes more sense for a free nation. We need to cut the fat. We need to instill much more intellectual rigor. And we need to find methodologies by which political capture of surveillance organizations, which is essentially what ICs become, unfortunately, both domestically and in foreign policy and in foreign affairs by extension. They become surveillance mechanisms, and with, married to a classification regime, all that does is spell mischief for polities that wish to remain legitimate and free. And finally, you may be curious, but look at the title that I have for this. I said, intelligence failure is a feature and not a bug. It's a feature and not a bug because of all of these things that I've just described, because they incentivize failure. They incentivize mischief. They incentivize political chicanery. And they incentivize behavior that condemns freedom and liberty to the dustbin of history. So with that, I'd like to thank you for listening. If you wish to comment on this, go to my Substack. I hope that you found a podcast provider, of course, that has let you listen to my bloviations. I would urge you to leave a review if possible. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. For this War Notes podcast series, Fixing Fight Club, I'm trying to get all of these episodes that I like to get out weekly instead of my usual fortnightly cadence on Chasing Ghosts, because I feel as if I'm in a run against time, because with a new political temper on the horizon, I want to make sure that I get everything committed to my podcast on what my recipe is to fix what's wrong in these particular things that I worry about when it comes to conflict at home and conflict abroad. Thanks for listening. This is Bill, out.